I was in the dugout, and the Dodgers always enjoyed putting on a show during infield practice. And they were practicing the double play, and I yelled out at Jackie, I said, "What time does the balloon go up?" Because he got so big. And he threw the ball at me in the dugout. Honest to gosh, he did. But, you know, we had a friendly adversary type relationship. Excuse me. But, you know, he belonged. He was a good ball player. And I'm proud of the fact that the National League got the first black ball player, and of course, looks what's happened since then.
Yeah,
we're gonna take a break here for 2 minutes.
Good.
Warren, let's go to 47. That was really your first significant year. You won 21 games, was obviously a big season. Can you talk about that year and what your recollections of it are?
Well, parts of it. I felt we had a contending ball club. I had a good year. I think I had an ERA of like 2.33. Ralph Branch and I won 20 ball games. He beat me out of the Cy Young Award, I remember that. And, well, it was a stepping stone for the rest of my career. And I felt that I belonged, I felt that I was a part of the starting rotation, and being successful doesn't hurt, you know. And so that was a great year for me personally. And also, I think for the Braves that, you know, this was the nucleus of the ball club that won the pennant the following year in 48. And we had a bunch of old guys, though. We had Peck's Bad Boys that we had Jeff Heath that came over from Cleveland. We had Bob Elliott that came from Pittsburgh along with Bill Salkeld and Jim Russell. You know, we just
was Sibby Sisti there?
Yes, we had a ball club that was experienced, maybe not as fleet of foot, but knew how to play the game, and we had good defense. So that you know, all those things contributed to us winning in 48, and that was all molded in 47.
Warren, you are a great pitcher. Talk to us about the effect or the role of a catcher. How important to you were your catchers? I know you had some great, Del Crandall played with you for right. many years, but in 47, as you started to go, were the catchers important? Did they help you pitch well, or did you call
sure.
your own game?
Faye, it's a communication between the pitcher and the catcher. And, you know, I was told that the catcher gives a sign so all the people on the defense know what's being thrown and they could move accordingly, but I don't think they're that smart. And
did you shake off catchers regularly if you wanted to throw something, or did you go with their...
No, I never shook them off, but I did stare them off. And location was more important to me than pitch.
So if a guy called a fastball and you wanted to throw the curve, you'd say, all right, I'll throw the fastball, but you'd decide where he wanted it?
No.
Or did you let him help you with the
location?
No,
I wanted the catcher to give me location. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like... if the catcher gives me fastball and go up and in, yeah, I like that. And then there's another place for the fastball, and it's down and away. So if I didn't like going inside on this hitter, I'd just stare him off, and then he'd go outside. Mm-hmm. So it didn't matter what pitch he called for, but it was important about the location of it. And also, one pitch sets up another one, is that, you know, change of speeds. Like I think is almost a lost art in baseball. It's coming back a little bit. But the breaking ball is a different speed than the fastball, and the change should be a different speed than the curveball. So now the hitter's got three options as to how quickly he strides and how quick he has to be to his hand. And every hitter is an egotist. You throw a fastball by a hitter and boy, he's gonna be reared up to hit that next one. And if you change up on him, he screws himself on the ground. And this, I think this was the attitude I had when I was pitching, is that I could nullify any hitter that came up there. And it wasn't with throwing a ball by him, but changing speeds.
Now, did you care much left-handed, right-handed in terms of hitting? I mean, Mize, let's say, comes up. Did you feel you had an advantage over Mize, who was a great hitter?
I was a better pitcher against a right-hander.
You were. And even without the screwball, though, this is before the screwball?
Well, at any time.
Yeah.
I always thought that opposing managers were stupid against me, that they should have put nine left-handers up there. That it seems like I had better control of a right-hander than I did a left-hander, because I saw more of them.
I was going to say there are more of them. Yeah.
And Mize is a good hitter. And for a big man, he had the smoothest swing. And he was hard to fool because he didn't stride very long. And I remember in the Polo Grounds, we wanted to keep him from pulling because of that short porch in right field. And then he started hitting home runs in left field. So it made him a tougher hitter. And, you know, every hitter has a personality. And I think it's the obligation of the pitcher to find out that personality. And it's always a contest between pitcher and catcher as to who respects who the most. And that's one thing I wanted from a hitter, is his respect. And there was a guy with Pittsburgh, the first baseman, we used to call him Cement Glove or whatever, poor man's Ralph Kiner. Who am I thinking of? Anyway, but I remember this is when Branch Rickey first brought the helmet into baseball, and he was up there hitting against me, and he took a vicious swing at a fastball I threw him. And I walked up to home plate and I said, "You swing like that again off me and I'm gonna knock you on your fanny." Well, his ego got the better and he took the helmet and threw it toward the dugout. He said, "You couldn't hurt me if you hit me." So now he's gonna hit the next fastball downtown. And I changed up on him and he screwed himself in the ground. And this is the only pleasure a pitcher gets, is fooling the hitter. Because I think every hitter thinks that pitcher is just a necessary evil of baseball. And I think baseball is going that way today, too, by the way.
How about pitching coaches? Did they ever play a role in helping you at all?
To a certain extent. Bucky Walters was our pitching coach, and I tried to get him to help me throw a slider. And he said, "You don't need a slider." Well, hell. So I tried to teach myself to throw a slider. And Bucky was a good pitcher in his own mind. And he had some young, great pitchers that he was trying to cultivate. So I think he spent more of his time with them than with me.
And so you were self-taught on the two additional pitches, the screwball and the slider?
Well, basically, yeah.
Did you worry about throwing the screwball hurting your arm?
No, because I didn't throw it the way Hubble threw it. I didn't throw it the way Arroyo did it. No, they all twisted their arm. And I remember Hubble, his arm, the palm of his hand was to the outside because he threw so many screwballs. But
how did you throw it?
We should stop tape here. These sirens are 5, 4,
okay.
3, 2, 1.
Can you tell us how you threw your screwball compared to Hubble and Arroyo
sure.
and the other guys?
Sure. Burdette was my roommate, and you know, I picked his brain a little bit about the screwball, but his screwball was different than mine. And there was a guy that was a pinch hitter for the Giants, Bobby Thompson, and every time I got in trouble against the Giants, he'd come up there and he had an open stance. And of course, that short porch in left field. So I was going to try to throw something that would go away from him, because obviously he couldn't handle the ball breaking away from him. That's why I didn't play against the right hander. So I played around with the screwball. And the curveball is this finger and your thumb, so that you did that with it. Well, the screwball, I felt that my ring finger was going to become my thumb, and this finger was going to be what I threw the screwball off of. So that between these two, I just turned the ball over. But I did it from my elbow to here, but not quit on it. You got to follow through. So it was easier on my arm, and it worked.
So you weren't snapping it the way they do. You were following, yeah.
Right. And I could tell when I threw the screwball correctly and not, that you could feel the ball come off your fingers. And this finger, as I say, right here, that dragged the ball effectively for me, much like your thumb is on the curveball. And it was self-taught. And when I first started throwing it, I couldn't even see it break. But when Thompson hit a ground ball to shortstop, I felt pretty good about it. And then I learned to change speeds with it. And as a result, I threw a fastball, curveball, screwball in place of my change, because the change and the screwball were comparatively the same speed and moved the same way. So the screwball was a much more valuable pitch for me.
Maybe I'll interrupt you, but I remember a conversation you and I had at Cooperstown with Williams, where Williams was arguing that pitchers were the dumbest people in baseball.
Oh, yeah.
And we had a wonderful discussion with him saying that pitchers all try to throw fastballs by good hitters like me, except Spahny, he said. He wouldn't do it. You remember that was a great conversation?
Oh, yeah. And you remember what Cooperstown was. We'd have our dinner and everybody get up and speak as we were around. And Ted got up and he said, all pitchers are stupid. And about 12 or 13 of those people were pitchers. And I was about the third person that spoke after Ted. And I said, well, Ted, if all these pitchers are stupid, how come you only hit 406? That 50% is 500, and you didn't hit that. And of course, I love to argue with Ted, because he loved to talk baseball, he loved to argue. And I used to deliberately get him to talk about hitting, just to hear him. Yeah. And the older that Ted got, the greater hitter he was when he was playing. And that thing in Cooperstown where it showed batting average where the ball was located in the strike zone, all through the strike zone. And Ted is one of my favorite people and a student of the game.
The true story or not, you experimented with a pitch in spring training against him and he remembered the following year,
you got the story right. No, I pitched against him in the All-Star game in Detroit in 1950. And the count went to 3-2, and I threw Ted my curveball, and he took it for strike three. And I didn't see Ted again until we played the City Series in Boston. And he come running out the left field where I was, and he said, when you start throwing a slider? Well, I didn't throw a slider, but when the greatest hitter in baseball called it a slider, I guess that's what it was. And he told me every pitch that I threw him during the time that he was at bat. And then he got the 3-2 pitch that I threw at the curveball.
You hadn't seen it before.
It amazed me that he knew every pitch I threw, and he said, that fastball that you threw to me is pretty effective. You ought to use it more often. So now we're playing in the All-Star game in Washington, D.C. And I remember what Ted had said. And I had two strikes on him, and I threw him a fastball right here. And he hit it high. And Jackie Robinson was playing second. And Dixie Walker was playing center. And Jackie went out. Dixie started coming in to catch that fly ball. And then they drifted, and they drifted, and drifted. And the ball went into the bleachers for a home run. And if you ever watch a pitcher during a ball game, when a guy hits a home run, you have nothing to do. You pick up the rosin bag and throw it and whatever. Well, I happened to think about Ted And I looked around at second base and I said, you conned me, didn't you? And he went, he did. You know, he used to spend the time that he wasn't hitting in a ball game looking through the hole in his cap, the little air hole, and watch the pitcher. Never watched anything else other than the pitcher. So that either they tipped pitches off or he had a good idea about what they were going to throw him. So he was great, but he wasn't that great. He had some inside information.
Tell us about Johnny Sain, who was your partner, and we're coming to 48, but tell us about the origination of the great phrase, Spahn and Sain, Sunday in Rain.
Well, that was in 1948 when a writer in Boston coined that phrase. And the scheduling, as you well know in New England, in September and late in August, there's a lot of rain. And also there's a lot of off days put in the schedule because of that. Well, it just so happened that during a course of, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks, that Sain would pitch, I would pitch, and then it rained, day off, then we'd come back, Sain and I. And poor Bickford was a great pitcher, and he didn't get a chance to pitch, and he hurt his arm at that time. So we were pitching every other game, John Sain and I. And this writer in Boston coined the phrase, Spahn and Sain and pray for rain. And in the annals of baseball, there's only a few things like that. Tinkers to Evers, the chance, the double play combination, and the great outfield of Hooper, Speaker, and Lewis. And then here along comes pitching, and not Feller, not anybody else, but Spahn and Sain and pray for rain. So I thought it was a great tribute.
Tell us about Johnny Sain. I remember him with a great curveball. Can you describe him as a pitcher?
Sure. John was a self-taught pitcher. He was playing in the minor leagues. And the manager, I think, had part ownership in the ball club. And he's the one that recommended Sain to the Braves. And John paid his own way to spring training. And he made the ball club because he was self-taught. He had a slider, curveball, great curveball. And he was reluctant about throwing his fastball. And, you know, he invented the slurve, which is in between a curveball and a slider. And John is the only guy I ever knew that sidearm left-handed hitters. You know, he would literally drop down and throw the ball into a left-handed hitter. And he got away with it. And then he developed a screwball to go along with it. But John was self-taught. John hated to run. And he was in the bullpen throwing almost every day. Mm. And Faye, this is one of the things I understand about baseball today, is that guys pitch once a week, they pitch 5 innings. They don't pitch in relief, they don't pitch batting practice. You know, to me, arm is like your legs. You got to use them to keep them in shape. And how in the heck can these guys today stay off the disabled list with what little throwing they do?
So you don't think that the more they pitch, the greater risk is that there's a limited number of pitches in an arm and they can use it?
I don't believe that. I don't believe that. I threw more than anybody ever. I did all the things you shouldn't do as a pitcher. I threw in the outfield and whatever. But I did it for rhythm. I did it to feel making the ball stay on the same plane and backspin and whatever. So it helped me in my pitching.
Did you pitch batting practice after you got to the majors?
Yes.
I wondered if that had something to do with it too. You pitched almost every day, maybe not the day after you pitched in a game, but the second day you pitched batting practice. You say, today, no pitcher pitches anything except in the bullpen. They don't pitch any batting practice.
No, I think it's a mistake. But they're getting paid too much money to do that. I thought it helped me because for location of the ball in the strike zone and being able to throw strikes when I wanted to. And heck, guys are all over the place. I can understand, like a John Rocker, I don't think he would be any good to throw batting practice because he can't throw strikes.
As we get to 48, can you talk about some of the guys you faced in the league? We talked a little bit about Mize. We've touched on Musial a little bit, but take maybe five or six of the great hitters that were in the league when you started in Brooklyn had some, and talk about the guys that you had trouble with who were maybe not the big stars, but the people that gave you the most trouble hitting.
There was a little guy who was Pittsburgh by the name of Roberts, Kurt Roberts. Probably hit me better than anybody in baseball. And, you know, it seemed like every time I raised my arm, he got a base hit. And thank God the right-handers got him out of the league for me. No, I think it's the timing of the rhythm of the pitcher and the rhythm of the hitter swinging the bat. And there are a lot of good hitters that I had good luck with. Wow, you know, I used to watch the line scores of the games before I pitched against the ball club. And a lot of times the guy that was hot was the guy that you had to watch out for, and the 300 hitter wasn't hitting or whatever. And so that I knew who I could take liberties with and who I couldn't. And there was a guy with Pittsburgh that hit home runs in successive games. I'm trying to think of what his name was.
Oh, I remember the first baseman, yeah.
No, you're thinking of Long.
Yeah.
No, Dale. This is an Italian guy, outfielder. He hit...
Simoli?
No. Oh, it was... I'll think of his name. But he hit home runs, maybe it was in the month of April or May, that he hit more home runs than anybody else. And we used to call him the poor man's Ralph Kiner. And he hit one of his home runs off me. I remember that. And then Dale Long, who hit eight home runs in eight games. I threw one of those. So, I did my share to help the guys that broke records.
Did you have a particular ballpark that you loved to pitch in or that you seemed to do well in? Was there a place that you enjoyed pitching?
Well, you always enjoy your own home park. I think that Milwaukee had reasonable distances, not termed a hitter's park.
What about Braves Field? Did you like that?
Well, Braves Field wasn't bad because we had a double fence in left field. You had to protect that short field and right field. That was a park that I enjoyed pitching in. I enjoyed pitching in the Polo Grounds. I enjoyed pitching in Wrigley Field. You know, I always felt this way, Faye. There's a negative and a positive to everything. And like in Wrigley Field with the wind blowing out, that wind was blowing against my breaking ball and my fastball, so it ought to move better. And in addition, ball carried so well that the outfielders had to play shorter. So I think there's a lot of outfielders that catch base hits, or that were base hits in other parks, that they wouldn't catch if you weren't in Wrigley Field. So I think pitching is keeping the ball from the line drive down. And if you pitch from the line drive up, you're going to get hurt. Mm-hmm. And Wrigley Field is a good example, and so is the Polo Grounds. And yet you had that big center field in the Polo Grounds. Ebbets Field was tough. Duke Snyder ought to be the mayor of Brooklyn because he hit against that, 297 or less?
In right field.
In right field.
And Musial liked that too.
Yeah, I know it. And he never faced the left-handed pitcher. I remember when I used to pitch against the Dodgers, Snyder wouldn't play. And a better guy played, who was the right-handed outfielder for the Dodgers?
Talk about the 48 season and the fact that you obviously had a good club and you were racing for the pennant. The Dodgers were a pretty good team, obviously.
Right.
And
every year we're chasing the Dodgers.
Right.
And I didn't have a real good year that year. I won 15 and lost 12. But I pitched in a lot of ball games where I was pinch hit for or was relieved in the latter part of the game. But we were in a pennant fight. And we also had a guy by the name of Nelson Potter and Bobby Hogue that were good relievers. So I think that was indicative. And I think the interesting thing about that was that my ERA in 48 was identical to another year when I won 20. So that, we had a good defensive ball club. Double play combination, center field pitching, and we were in a lot of ball games that we weren't the year before.
15 and 12, but I understand that the 15 were key, crucial. The one that I read about was 14 in a game against Brooklyn. That kind of helped put the pennant away.
Oh, thank you. You're nice. I like you. I don't know that, but every game was important. And when you played the Dodgers, they were doubly important because of the difference of a game in the win column and the loss column. And I remember one year that the Dodgers started out 22-3, and we were winning, and yet we were like 8 games behind because they got off to such a great start. But they had a good organization. They had good instructors in their organization. They also had some good talent. And I remember when we got center fielder Sam Jethro. I remember Branch Rickey saying we stole the best prospect they had in the Dodger organization. Bull. They knew he couldn't see, and he ran on his heels. And I saw that guy run right by fly balls that he ran so hard, it took him 10 minutes to retrieve the ball after he ran by it. But, they knew what they had.
How about memories of the 48 World Series? I mean, that was a series with Cleveland, and Gene Bearden had been their great pitcher, knuckleball pitcher. And talk about the series, just your recollections of that. That was your first World Series.
Yes. Well, Sane beat Feller in the first game. And that was that disputed play at second base. Macy was the runner. And Feller and Boudreaux had a great pickoff. And all the pictures on video and whatever looked like he was out, but Boudreaux caught the ball behind the bag. Mm-hmm. And I remember the umpire was from Boston.
Stewart.
Bill Stewart. And they claimed it was a home
field advantage.
Yeah.
Well, opinion or whatever. And we did a TV show.